From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Merry Christmas to you and yours with the Christian celebration of the birth of Jesus coming up on Wednesday. This weekend also marks the pagan observance of the winter solstice, and happy Kwanzaa to everyone observing that holiday, which begins this Thursday. This program, State of Belief, is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners like you. And we're very thankful for that. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. Now here's what's coming up on this week's show.
The way we feel God is through love. When I look back over my life, you know, from a little boy, I can sense those moments when God was like, here I am.
Those are the words of a Texas pastor who's built a remarkable ministry of no-nonsense theology, nurturing community, and a passion for social justice. Rudy Rasmus has followed an undeniably non-traditional path to the pulpit of Houston's 9,000-member, improbably diverse St. John's United Methodist Church. And on this week's show, you'll hear his inspiring story.
Time magazine have named Pope Francis as their person of the year. He's the third pontiff to be given the title.
Progressives love him. Both Time and the LGBT magazine The Advocate named him their man of the year. Meanwhile, some public conservatives have voiced their disaffection with what they perceive as his undoctrinal statements. Others insist that his words change nothing about the church he leads and its role in the world. Such is the impact of Pope Francis, who just celebrated his 77th birthday this week after his first year as head of the Roman Catholic Church. Journalist Sarah Posner has been looking at how the people in the pews, as well as disaffected Catholics and people of other faith traditions, view this still new pope. And she'll be with us on this week's show to share some of her observations and analysis. Plus, the 12 tweets of Christmas.
The rooms are full at Bethlehem Inn, but there's a rustic barn out back that is quite charming, and the hay is complimentary.
You remember Janet Reese, who spent 4 years summarizing every chapter of the Bible and tweeting them? Now, the best of those tweets have been released in book form and just in time for the holiday. She's back on State of Belief with some seasonal scripture in 140 characters or less. But first,
war on Christmas,
working to try to get rid of these public expressions of faith.
A nearly 6-foot-tall Festivus pole made from empty beer cans.
Angry atheists who are armed with an attorney.
Replacing Merry Christmas with Happy Holidays.
If there's a war on Christmas, Christmas is winning.
It's become something of a holiday tradition. Dire warnings of a massive war on Christmas with anecdotal evidence and hyperbolic warnings of all that's right and good with this country disappearing like melting snow on a warm day. Now, as much as this fictional narrative serves a purpose in the culture wars and, of course, in fundraising appeals, do everyday Americans surrounded with the trappings of the season wherever they go really feel like there is an attack on Christmas? And how widespread is the observance of this holiday, so deeply religious and secular at the same time? We're very fortunate that the Public Religion Research Institute, in cooperation with Religion News Service, has gone out and asked these questions, as well as many others, about the role Christmas time plays in their lives. And here to share some of the eye-opening findings of the December survey is the CEO of PRRI, Dr. Robert P. Jones. Robbie, welcome back.
Thanks, Welton. Happy to be here.
Season's greetings.
Or is it Merry Christmas?
I'm not sure.
Yeah,
Robbie, it's always fun when the Public Religion Research Institute takes on something that has sort of become conventional wisdom and applies rigorous research to the subject. For example, many of us lament how commercialized the American celebration of Christmas has become, but you found high percentages of people focusing on the religious aspects of the holiday. Tell us about that.
We found out that about 9 in 10 Americans celebrate Christmas. That includes 84% of Americans who celebrate Christmas and no other holiday. Might be interesting to know that 6% of Americans celebrate Christmas along with some other holiday. So sort of interfaith Christmas, another 6% celebrate another holiday but not Christmas, and then 5% don't celebrate any holidays at all. But overall, 9 in 10 celebrate Christmas. And we did find that, you know, 42% of Americans say that they celebrate it as a strongly religious holiday. About 3 in 10 say they celebrate it as a somewhat religious holiday. And then about a quarter of Americans say that they largely celebrate it as a non-religious holiday. So pretty broad spectrum here. But about 4 in 10 saying that they celebrate it as a strongly religious holiday.
What do the people say that you talk to about how they observe the day?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It really is a mix of, you know, the sacred and the secular mixed up together. Just a couple of examples here. The most popular activity is watching Christmas movies, such as A Wonderful Life or A Christmas Story. Nearly 8 in 10 Americans say that they watch Christmas movies during the holiday. But in terms of, like, doing stuff, a large percentage of Americans, 6 in 10, say they will attend religious services on Christmas Eve or Christmas Day. That's a fairly high percentage.
It certainly is. There is not a big generational gap here.
What I was saying before was that when we asked Americans to think back to their Christmas as children, how religious mm-hmm. was that experience? Americans today say it was roughly the same as it is for their families today. So they're carrying out roughly the same kinds of religious practices, or at least the amount of religious practices as they were as children. But evangelicals, it seems, have made a concerted effort to up the religious content of their Christmas celebrations, and that marks them different from other religious organizations.
Well, that's really significant because here, for the first time, the old-time religion is not as good as the new-time religion.
It's interesting, yeah. So there's been a real shift here.
Huh. Well, the war on Christmas has been a much-touted subject on the right in recent years. You actually polled on how people feel about hearing Happy Holidays versus Merry Christmas, so talk about that and tell us what to say.
Yeah, well, I think the first thing to say is that, you know, this is mostly a debate going on over the heads and behind the backs of, I think, you know, most Americans. It doesn't seem like there's a lot of energy here. We asked 3 years ago. We asked again today. The picture that emerges is Americans are divided on the question, but 3 years ago were more inclined to say they'd rather hear Merry Christmas over Happy Holidays. This year, the balance has shifted. So more Americans than not say that they think it's more appropriate for businesses to greet their customers using the term Happy Holidays than the more religious term Merry Christmas.
Have you done this same kind of polling in other years?
So we just did it 2010 and 2013. So we had these kind of two snapshots.
And what do you see? I mean, what are the commonalities?
Well, I think we sort of see the basic battle lines are the same. So, for example, this year, about 6 in 10 Republicans say they think businesses should use Merry Christmas. About 6 in 10 Democrats say the opposite, that businesses should use Happy Holidays. So, you know, we do see these sort of divides. Evangelicals on one side saying, you know, strong majority saying we should use Merry Christmas. The religiously unaffiliated or the nuns, on the other hand, not surprisingly, but along with minority Protestants saying, no, stores should actually use the more generic greeting that's more appropriate in our pluralistic society today.
Robbie, when you put together the views on the one side and the activities on the other side, are they similar? Because I get the feeling that though for fundraising purposes or whatever, these people that are saying there is a war on Christmas, the general population is not seeing a war on Christmas. It's actually celebrating Christmas with more vigor than ever. Yeah. Isn't that right?
It's certainly pretty ubiquitous when you walk around, I think, in public space. You know, what I think the heart of these questions are about the underlying shifting dynamics in the American religious landscape, and people sense that particularly the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant or assumed majority is declining, and that's absolutely true. So, you know, one quick example that on the question of like whether the Christmas story is historically accurate in the way it's depicted in the Bible, there's been an 18-point drop in how many Americans say that the Christmas story is historically accurate over the last decade. So in 2004, two-thirds of Americans said they believed that the Christmas story was historically accurate. That number today is 49%, less than half. The main reason for that is because of the shifting religious landscape. We have far fewer white evangelical Protestants today in the country. In fact, 10 percentage points less. They made up 28% of the country a decade ago, down to 18% today. They're the group most likely to believe in biblical literalism and a literal reading of the Bible, and including the Christmas story. And the number of religiously unaffiliated Americans over the past decade has doubled from 11% to 22%. So that sort of demographic shift has, in fact, move the needle on where Americans overall are on this question.
Do you have a sense that among the 90-plus percent people who actually celebrate Christmas in one way or another, how many of those actually tie it to a scriptural narrative about the birth of Jesus?
We don't have a direct measure of that, but I think the best proxy we have for it is people who say they see it as a strongly religious holiday, which, again, is about 4 in 10 Americans. Yeah.
What really caught your eye when you scanned through your findings the first time?
Yeah. You know, I think this dramatic shift over the last decade was one of the first things that caught my eye. That, I mean, our question asked it this way, you know, is the story in the Bible, we mentioned, you know, the star, Bethlehem, the wise men, the virgin birth, all of it, historically accurate, the way we asked it, or is it a theological story designed to instill faith in Jesus Christ? Those are the two options in the question. And we certainly have, you know, sort of, again, less than half answering that question now compared to two-thirds before. I think that really is a real shift. Just to kind of check this, we also noted that there's been a corresponding decline in the number of Americans who say that the Bible is literally true over the same period. Yep. Part of that's demographics, younger people, but part of it is the rise of the religiously unaffiliated in the country as well.
Dr. Robert P. Jones is founding CEO of the Public Religion Research Institute. Together with Religion News Service, PRRI has just released the results of their December survey, and it's full of insights regarding how Americans experience and celebrate Christmas. You can find the full report online at publicreligion.org. Robbie, thanks so much for coming in today to discuss these results. And I say to you, whatever you want to hear from me regarding greetings for the season.
Yeah, I'm open to all of it. All right. Thanks a lot.
Take care.
Yep.
Dr. Jana Reese is a writer and author who spent 4 years meticulously distilling every chapter of the Bible into that most contemporary of communication forms, the tweet. Now she's published a book, The Twible, all the chapters of the Bible in 140 characters or less, now with 68% more humor. And Jana's back with us now to share some of our holiday cheer and to talk about this innovative format that she has developed. Jana, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much.
Congratulations on the release of the book. Since we're well into the Christmas season, I was hoping you would share some seasonal scripture in Twible form.
All right. Well, so I chose 12 tweets of Christmas, and these are taking people through the birth of Jesus all the way through the resurrection of Jesus. So as you can imagine, there's a lot that's left out, but I hope this will get the gist of the story and be entertaining too.
Okay.
All right, the 12 tweets of Christmas. 1. Just when you thought we'd left the Old Testament, here's a string of begats to put you at ease. Ancestry.com says JC's descended from David. Woot! 2. Astrologers are sent on a field trip to find a Messiah child somewhere out west. Quote, a star. Could you be more specific? Unquote. 3. Teen girl Mary, chosen by G, to bear the Savior. Okay, the pregnancy raises some eyebrows, but a double thumbs up to Joseph for loyalty. 4. Quote, ma'am, the rooms are full at Bethlehem Inn, but there's a rustic barn out back that is quite charming, and the hay is complimentary. Unquote. 5. Taste of Galilee is a hit, When J.C. feeds 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish, can he also multiply chocolate cake for dessert? 6. J.C. uses his own saliva to heal a man born blind. So the first thing the guy sees is a stranger spitting on him. Hello, cruel world. 7. J.C., quote, love one another as I have loved you, unquote. It's really not much to ask, you know, just be willing to die for others. Oh, there's that. 8. J.C. raises a girl from the dead. Good thing she was only 12. If she'd been a teen, she would have slept all day until she wanted to get up. 9. The 12 freak out when J.C. wants to wash their feet, but at least he doesn't use his own spit this time. That's progress. 10. There's nothing funny about Jesus dying on a cross. Sorry. Catch up with me in the next chapter.
Oh.
11. Doubting Tom mauls J.C.'s wounds to make sure his resurrection's the real deal. J.C., quote, ouch, couldn't you just take my word for it, unquote. And 12. J.C. to Pete, quote, do you love me with agape love, unquote. Pete, quote, sure, I friended you 3 times on Facebook, unquote. J.C., quote, fair enough, feed my lambs, unquote.
You know, that's kind of an annotated twibble. You've got scripture and you've got Jana's commentary, and you did really well. And I know that there's more than one congregation in this country that would welcome an abbreviated version of the Christmas story and all the rest. So, Jana, talk briefly about the process of curating the multi-year Bible tweeting project into book form.
I like the word curating. That's a wonderful thing, because I think that is a lot of what's going on here, taking the gist of a story, trying to distill it down to its narrative, but also trying to make it fresh and entertaining to people in the culture that we live in today. Not always easy. Some of the passages were a little bit hard to relate to modern life, especially Leviticus, for example, or the Book of Numbers. But some of it is just timeless and wonderful.
The hard work of taking something that we all think we know well and then reworking it into a different form can provide truly unique insights. There's an element of a monk painstakingly hand-lettering the Bible in ancient times to your work. What did getting this intimate with the Bible do to you? Did you find something new? Did you feel something different?
I found new things almost every day. You know, there are 1,189 chapters of the Bible, which is a long time of your life if you're tweeting it out one chapter a day. And so that pace required me to spend a lot of time with the text and also with commentaries so I could see what other people were saying about it. And so, yes, I learned a ton. For example, I learned something that I never knew about the first temple in Jerusalem, which was that it was probably only about 2,700 square feet. We think of this temple, you know, Solomon's temple, as being a huge, grand, amazing wonder of the ancient world. But in fact, it was not that large. You know, you could fit about 100 of them in a Walmart supercenter today. Hmm. So thinking about that in scale was really interesting to me. I learned a ton.
When you think about a reader going through your book, the twibble, what do you hope readers get out of that? What do you want them to feel or think when they put it down?
Well, that's a great question. A couple of things. The first is I want them to laugh. I want them to have a wonderful time with the Bible. I think people are so many times so intimidated by the Bible and kind of afraid to try it, or they feel that they should know more about it than they do. So the twibble, you know, seeks to entertain. And then the second thing I hope is that they will be educated. You know, they will leave this reading experience not only laughing, but more informed about the Bible and looking at it as an overall story rather than just trying to understand little tiny bits of it, but getting the bird's eye view of the whole Bible. I just had a pastor buy 20 copies of it for his confirmation class, which I thought was wonderful. You know, he thinks that it's a good way for 8th and 9th graders to understand the Bible and to not think of the Bible as something that's boring or something that's for other people, but something that's for them.
Dr. Jenna Reese is a scholar, a writer, an author. Her latest project is The Twible, All the Chapters of the Bible in 140 Characters or Less, now with 68% more humor. You may even think it's more than 68%. I've described Jenna's work in the past as irreverent but always respectful, and that certainly continues to be true. Jenna, let me just say Merry Christmas and thank you for once again being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and I wish you the best of Christmases.
Non-traditional doesn't even begin to describe Pastor Rudy Rasmus' story. A former brothel owner, he spent the past 21 years growing St. John's United Methodist Church in Houston, Texas, from 9 to 9,000 members, and touching many, many more thousands along the way. The congregation is notable for both its incredible diversity and its broad outreach to those in need, and I am so very pleased to have Pastor Rudy join me now on State of Belief Radio. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing, Reverend Gaddy?
Would you please explain a little bit about the history of the church, your background, how you got into the church and came to be doing what you're doing?
My daddy taught me to never trust preachers and church people. He said they were all full of something, and I believed him, which means it took me a long time to actually get to the church. Uh-huh. But I met a girl that I fell in love with who was a church girl. And when we married, I followed her to church, and I sat on the pew, Reverend Gaddy, for 5 years, really looking for what normally people with my background normally look for with church people, and that is pride and hustle, you know? But I sat on that pew week after week, year after year, and for 5 years, I discovered that those people who told me they loved me actually meant it, and ultimately I became a Christian. Took a step almost immediately out of my family business, which was that what we actually call it a borderline brothel versus versus full fledged. Because you know that's really illegal. You know what I mean?
Oh, but, I see. Okay.
But borderline, really, from the standpoint, this business was really it was a sexually oriented business designed for the prostitution trade.
I see.
And I was in that business my entire adult life.
Good grief.
Yeah. And, you know, when I came to church and ultimately becoming a Christian, almost immediately I felt a real compelling urge to do something good. That's a big word, good.
Sure.
But I felt the urge to do something good. And ultimately, the ministers and pastors on the church campus where I became part of the faith actually, you know, gave me some direction in terms of ministry. Mm-hmm. I didn't know really what ministry meant, but one particular pastor told me one day it meant to serve, and that was it.
Right. Yeah. Well, what do you attribute the astounding growth of your membership to? I mean, we're talking about going from 9 to 9,000 members.
You know, we have really discovered the power of unconditional love. That is, love without conditions. Mm-hmm. And often, you know, it's just kind of crazy. But instinctively, as human beings, we place conditions on the person in front of us as to whether or not we're going to accept that person for who they are and where they are. Mm-hmm. Well, at this church in Houston, Texas, St. John's, we have, from the first day, approached every human being that has walked through the door with what I call the unconditional love of God. And the transformative power of this love in a person's life, regardless to where they are. I mean, now, imagine this. This congregation comes from 150 zip codes. That means every neighborhood in Houston is represented on the pew. Isn't that crazy?
It is, yeah.
Every neighborhood. Amazing. But the one common denominator for every person, be it black, white, straight, gay, rich, poor, educated, uneducated, homeless, or seven bedrooms, is the need for love and the pain that we all dragged through life. And that common denominator comes to that place, and ultimately we find ourselves not only in community, but as family.
Rudy, how do you translate unconditional love into palpable ways of outreach so that people who don't know what you're talking about when you say unconditional love, how do they learn it?
We have really had to instruct over the years because it's not something instinctive for the average human being.
Mm-hmm.
This unconditional love really is the practice and the process of accepting the person in front of you and understanding that person's need for the same compassion that you need.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an exercise, and we teach this exercise in our faith community, and we call it the compassion exercise.
Mm.
But imagine this. You are face-to-face with a person who is the other. That means the person that you probably would never share a cup of coffee with in any point in your life. You're standing face-to-face with the other. And the exercise is to look at that person and say to yourself, just like me, that person needs love. That person needs compassion. That person needs to be understood. That is the hardest thing for a person to do, but once you do it, it becomes the easiest thing to do.
Sure. What are the forms of outreach, the substance of the ministries, the kinds of service that come out of your church as an expression of that?
The primary outreach that we've been involved in for the 22 years that we've been in that place has been to the homeless community in and around downtown Houston.
Hmm.
When we got to this building, Reverend Gaddy, in 1992, there were homeless folks sleeping literally on the doorsteps. And when we got to that doorstep, we had a choice.
Hmm.
We could step over that person and close the door behind us, or we could awaken that person and bring them in with us.
Hmm.
We just decided to bring the folk in with us. And from that moment, it was clear that our primary mission was going to be to marginalized people. Now, what we've discovered over these 20 years is that marginalization extends beyond homelessness.
Sure.
And we've extended the circle to every marginalized people group over these 20 years that would ultimately find themselves not welcomed at church.
Hmm.
You know, so we welcome, you know, we say, okay, so you don't feel comfortable at church, come hang out with us. And that is an amazing, amazing outreach
yeah.
to a city where, you know, people for the most part all over the country, for the most part, don't really feel comfortable
mm-hmm.
in church often, unless they were church folks at some point along the way and have what we also call situational esteem. So, you know, you have to have a certain esteem, self-esteem,
mm-hmm.
to walk into some rooms. And you have to have a lot of self-esteem to walk into most church rooms.
What part of what you do you find most rewarding?
I'll give you an example. A dear friend of mine just lost a child.
Mm-hmm.
And in that process of losing that child, this close friend of mine contemplated the relevance of God.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did from the moment of that child's illness through that child's funeral, I showed consistent love and compassion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What my friend told me a couple of days ago, right after the child's funeral, he said, Rudy, you helped me stay in this thing
mm-hmm.
called faith.
Yeah.
By the tangible evidence of your love. So the reward for me was a person experiencing the love of God through my actions.
Yeah. I want to go all the way back now to one of the first things that you told me, and that is you said that in your former life you didn't trust ministers, you didn't trust churches. what is it now that you're in a church, now that you are a minister, and you have those memories of how you felt, what are you conscientiously doing that you wish someone had done to you early in life?
You know, at St. John's, we call it pimp-proofing. We pimp-proof our congregation to help them to be resilient when it comes to the unfortunate experiences in many churches.
Mm-hmm.
What happened early on is that my dad always equated preachers to pimps.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've done at St. John's in an effort to counteract that presence or even that belief is, one, we've been extremely consistent as expressions of ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, we have not necessarily lived the shiniest, blingiest life.
Mm-hmm.
I drive a 13-year-old pickup truck, and I'm pretty comfortable in that truck, and people expect me to drive something different.
Mm-hmm.
I've never worn a suit in this building for worship services over the last 20 years, and there's an expectation that I am supposed to be, you know, shinier than anybody
mm-hmm.
on the pew.
Mm-hmm.
In the process, I have demonstrated what I mentioned earlier, and that is the presence of unconditional acceptance
yeah.
for every person who's walked through the door.
Mm.
And that demonstration really has been more powerful than my 13-year-old truck, my blue jeans, and my lack of shininess.
Yeah.
It's the acceptance that has made sure. the biggest difference in people moving through their isms and the big chasm that exists between people in the church at this particular place.
How is St. John's celebrating Christmas?
Well, first of all, we remind people that Christmas is not our birthday,
mm-hmm.
and that there is something larger happening in this moment we call the Advent season.
Yes.
Where we have celebrated the anticipation of the birth of Jesus. And in that place, we help people to do four things. One, to worship fully, and that is to give themselves to something, to an idea larger than anything they can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, we encourage people to spend less. And at the same time, we encourage people to give more. You know, spend less mm-hmm. on the items that you know you won't value or even remember 1 month after Christmas,
mm-hmm.
and to give to someone and something that is beyond ourselves that could help humanity. Number four, we ask people to love all. And in that process, the world changes one relationship at a time to the mm-hmm. point where we can ultimately experience peace on this planet. And that's the real goal.
Pastor Rudy Rasmus is co-pastor of St. John's United Methodist Church in Houston, Texas. And I'm so pleased that on this particular show, we could have you, Pastor Rudy, in our presence and sharing your story with us. I thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio, and wish blessings on you and your church.
Thank you, Reverend Gaddy.
He's on the cover of Time magazine as Man of the Year. He's provoked responses from the entire ideological spectrum with his no-nonsense, justice-driven approach to Catholicism. Pope Francis has certainly shaken things up, and our friend Sarah Posner has devoted some time to looking at some of the responses he's inspired in his first year. Sarah, it's great to have you back on State of Belief.
Thanks, Wilton. It's nice to be back.
It seems that a variety of groups find it easy to project their own interpretations on the words of this pope. Conservatives insist he's not really saying anything differently. Progressives experience him as a revolutionary. What are your thoughts on him?
Progressives are having what I call the liberal swoon over Pope Francis, because I think they've gotten used to the papacies of John Paul II and Benedict, where there was so much emphasis on what Catholic theologian Dan McGuire calls the pelvic issues.
Mm-hmm.
And this pope is saying, hey, let's dial that back a little bit and focus on some other things like poverty and economic inequality. And those ideas are not non-Catholic ideas. And they also are ideas that didn't disappear during the previous two papacies. It was just a matter of emphasis. And the social encyclicals in the Catholic Church laying the groundwork for this sort of Catholic social teaching go back over 100 years. So he's not deviating from tradition at all. He just has a very different style and approach, which includes not making any changes on the pelvic issues, just not talking about them as much.
A recent Washington Post ABC News poll shows Pope Francis as more popular among both progressive and conservative Catholics than his predecessor, mm-hmm. which actually runs counter to many of the assumptions that we've heard from various commentators. How is he connecting to such a diverse church membership?
Well, I think that for most Catholics, it's probably difficult for them to say, I don't like the Pope. Mm-hmm. There have been Catholic critics. There have been non-Catholic critics, like there's the Rush Limbaugh criticism where he calls him a Marxist. But there's also Catholic criticism, which basically says that the apostolic exhortation that he published at the end of November that was largely about spiritual issues, but also about, this is the document where he criticized trickle-down economics.
Mm-hmm.
The Bishop of Madison, Wisconsin said, you know, this doesn't really rise to the level of papal infallibility. It's just something that we need to take into consideration. It's not, you know, written in stone. And they have sort of a more of a Tea Party-esque, libertarian, conservative take on economics, and they're trying to, you know, put a square peg in a round hole in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that even so, you will still hear those conservative Catholics who are conservative on the economic issues and have qualms about the way Pope Francis has been talking about economic inequality and unfettered capitalism. They still will talk about how much they love that he's a man of the people and how he speaks in plain language and that he's calling on Catholics to be spiritual and think about their faith. And as Bishop Morlino, the Bishop of Madison, said, you know, look Jesus in the eye. And so I think that even if they have this economic policy disagreement with him,
mm-hmm.
they still see him as a positive for the church because people are reacting so positively to him. And if there's something that the church has needed over the past 20 years, it's some good PR
yeah.
in light of the, you know, the sex abuse scandal and how Benedict was just so perceived as being just kind of not accessible to people. And he was an arch conservative. And that's not to say that Francis is a flaming liberal, although in comparison, he looks like it. And a lot of that is due to just the way he's able to interact with people on a human level.
What about lay Catholics and particularly people who have left the church? Are they seeing a rekindling of hope?
I think so. I think that for many of them, leaving the church had to do with the overemphasis on the things that Francis said that the church was obsessing about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they welcome his renewed emphasis on the existence of economic inequality and the hope for economic equality. But you have to remember that the hierarchy in the United States is still in place, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
you still have bishops who are extremely conservative. You still have priests who are extremely conservative. And even though Francis is saying don't emphasize abortion and same-sex marriage so much, be more pastoral.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, in their mind, they're going to be pastoral, but they're not going to stop emphasizing those issues. I mean, that is abundantly clear from the way the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops is responding to him.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if it necessarily means that Catholics are going to start returning to the church. I think that they're happy with Francis,
mm-hmm.
but if they go to their neighborhood parish, they still might have to hear a lot about abortion and same-sex marriage.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that I wonder, and I loved your term that progressives are demonstrating their papal swoon.
Uh-huh.
I just wonder if there's going to come a time when progressives don't have the papal swoon. Because, for example, in the United States, I know that there are some Catholic women who are not pleased that he hasn't gone farther in talking about the role of women in the church.
Right, exactly. His phrasing in talking about the role of women in the church is very paternalistic. He says the door is closed on women's ordination, but that women nonetheless have a special role to play in the church, which is not a leadership role.
Right.
And there's the church's stance on homosexuality, abortion, and contraception. And then there's also the matter of the nuns, mm-hmm. because even the N-U-N-S, I know sometimes right. we talk about the N-O-N-E-S, but I'm yes. actually talking about the nuns. You know, there's been no change from the Vatican on the investigation of the American nuns for heresy.
Mm-hmm.
I've spoken to some people, and they say they've gotten no word on this new pope scaling that investigation back at all.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have the new pope being lauded for emphasizing Catholic social teaching, yet the nuns are still being investigated for basically living out Catholic social
right.
teaching.
Yeah.
It's kind of a disconnect that I think for a lot of progressive Catholics is still hard to get their minds around.
Regardless of the opinions of all these groups, the Pope has indeed began to re-energize the church, and he has given a signal that it is more relevant in today's culture than it seemed to be a decade ago.
Well, I do think he's re-energizing the church. I think it'll be really interesting to watch because I think that the conservatives in the United States, mm-hmm. political conservatives, have tried to say that what the church has to say on these issues is relevant, what the church has to say about same-sex marriage and abortion and contraception. And now that he's saying these things, they're kind of like, well, you know, this is not papal infallibility, and, you know, I'm not really sure what he's talking about, unfettered capitalism, mm-hmm. and I'm just going to pretend that I didn't really hear those words and what they really mean. And so I think that what you might see is an attempt to dial back the role of the Pope in American public policy by conservatives and an effort to dial it up among progressives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's going to be a really interesting thing to watch because there are questions about whether the Pope should play a role in setting our public policy and mm-hmm. laws anyway. But I think that the terms of that engagement have shifted.
Well, I also think you've pointed at critical moments when you talk about the Pope's appointment of cardinals and bishops, because there's where the real change in the United States, particularly, yes. that's where it's going to come.
Yes, and not to be crass about this, but people have got to die before that happens. You know, I mean,
that's right.
You know, he's going to get new appointments to make when somebody passes on.
Right.
And so until that happens, nothing's going to change in terms of the makeup of the U.S. hierarchy.
Yeah. Sarah, have you run into any surprises in writing about Pope Francis?
I think that a lot of the coverage of Francis has overstated how happy American Catholics are with him.
Huh.
I think for many, especially on the progressive side, they're happy but cautiously optimistic. And I think that the coverage generally doesn't touch on that. It's such a good story that this pope is who he is from a reporting perspective that I think that there's not a lot of reflection on some of these issues surrounding, you know, the time and how long it'll take for these changes to be made and how intractable the hierarchy is.
Mm.
What I came across was not this sort of unfettered enthusiasm, if you will, but
mm-hmm.
like I said, a cautious optimism and, you know, a gladness that he is emphasizing these issues.
And, you know, it's an optimism, Sarah, that has to be able to survive people whose attention span doesn't last long on any one person or subject.
Yes. And I think that that is part of the problem with media coverage of him is that, you know, if you look at a lot of coverage that's used to being at the pace of the 24/7 media cycle, they're expecting something to happen overnight. So they want to have a story be about some quick cataclysmic
right.
change within the church.
Right.
And it's just not moving at that same pace.
No. Sarah Posner is a widely published journalist whose work appears in Religion Dispatches, Salon, and Mother Jones, and Al Jazeera America. She is in other publications as well. Sarah, I've missed you, and I really am glad to be talking with you again, and I'm thankful that you could join us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton. The pleasure is mine.
Now, before we go, Over the past month, we've heard a lot of protests, complaints, whining, and outcries about what the various observances of this holiday season are all about. Atheists placed a large ad in Times Square conveying the message of who needs God to celebrate peace and joy. They want to take Christ out of Christmas and celebrate Xmas. While some people have seen the sign and yawned, others, like one Jewish man in New York, has associated the atheist's ad with the Holocaust, and as a Jew, defended Christianity and the meaning of the season for Christians, scandalizing the atheist message. Remarkably this year, we've gone from how best to articulate the greetings of the season to arguments about whether or not Santa Claus is a white person or a person of color. Yes, all of this debate can be serious if we allow it, but I have another perspective on it. Everybody's getting to express a point of view in public. That's good. The argument about rights and religions is underway with vigor. I actually smile as I listen and watch because I see the American people energized about their personal opinions and realization of the importance of religious freedom in protecting everyone's right to take their ideas to the public. Those who celebrate Christmas will do so with great energy and emotion. Those who oppose the celebration will share their message as well. Religions will defend each other, and some will denounce all religions. And all in the heated conversations can still be neighbors. Rather than wail and weep about the demise of our nation, let's give thanks for the pluralism of this land that gives everybody a platform, and let's express gratitude for a nation that can find unity with diversity. The give and take in pluralism is a real blessing as long as our goal is not to support a theocracy, but to keep trying to practice a democracy, supportive of equality for all and demagoguery for none. Happy holidays, everybody. Religious freedom is still working. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to us today. We'll use it wisely to keep State of Belief on the air and to expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show. You can hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. I hope you'll stay in touch with us throughout the week. Facebook, Twitter are good media for us. There are also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line for State of Belief is 202-681-4246. We encourage you to tell others about the show, encourage them to listen, join the dialogue, and join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. See what he was.